You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
The thing that I am incredibly excited about is sort of the point in history where we are, the speed at which innovation is happening across AI, across med tech, you know, biotech, climate tech. So it feels exhilarating to be alive at this point in history. And I feel like people who drive change in the world are the people who are crazy enough to think that they can do so. One of the things that I think that we could do in New Zealand is really sort of focus on force of nature people and talent ecosystems.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz. We're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. Today, we're talking to Privahini Bradu, an immigrant to New Zealand in her school years. She's now living up in San Francisco, where she's built a career as a successful entrepreneur, merging her passion for science and business. But her time down under was impactful. During her time at the University of Auckland, Privahini led the establishment of the Spark Business Competition, now Velocity, and led it as a founding CEO, and also founded Chasma, an organization dedicated to linking the biotech academic community with industry. Meanwhile, she also graduated first class honors in biomedical science, went on to complete a PhD in neurogenetics and drug discovery, and not stopping there, in 2006 landed a Fulbright scholarship to pursue an MBA at Harvard in the States, after which she took a leap into the commercial world, joining LanzaTech as one of the first commercial hires in the US, before founding Blue Oak to revolutionize how we treat and recycle end-of-life electronics, raising $50 million from Kleiner Perkins and others along the way. Today, she's mostly focused on a new company, Plank, building tools to help scale remote engineering teams, and is spending a lot of time thinking about AI and how we'll build companies in the future. This was a great conversation, so let's go get stuck in. I am delighted to be here with Privahini Bradu. Priv, it's an absolute pleasure. Welcome to the Diaspora.nz podcast. It's good to have you.
Yay, excited to be here.
You've been living here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm excited to be in person for this recording. You've been here for about 15 years, give or take, and your career expertise has spanned some fascinating companies and journeys I'm excited to learn a lot more about. But how would you introduce yourself? Who are you today? Why do you think we're having this conversation?
Oh, thanks, David. I'm very excited to be here. In terms of who I am today, I am a Kiwi living in San Francisco. My parents are from India. I was born there. I grew up in Oman. And today I run a company called Plank. I founded this company a few years ago. We are squarely at the intersection of the future of work in AI. Two areas I'm extremely excited about. When we started the company, we were bootstrapped. This is my second company, and you know that's a whole story in itself, but it was really important to me to be building a company which was focused on profitability early on. So we got a profitability in the first 3 months and have been growing rapidly ever since. This was before COVID that we started remote work. Again, can go into it. And then COVID obviously helped.
You've raised millions of dollars of venture in the past. We're going to talk more about that. You have also had a hell of a journey and a rapid growth ramp with Plank today. I want to go all the way back, though. You mentioned born in India, immigrant to New Zealand. If you don't mind sharing, like, what drove the move originally? I'm fascinated by the immigrant mindset and whether it's first generation moving with parents or second generation, you know, child of immigrants is something that can be really motivating at an early age. Walk us through that story.
Yeah, happy to share. So I was raised in Oman. My early childhood was in Oman. And my dad, I believe, had a friend who was Kiwi who said, you should absolutely check New Zealand out. And I think, I want to say we went together for a trip. We all loved it. And my parents actually ended up staying behind in Oman. At the time, you could actually get your permanent residence without living in New Zealand back in the day. But I was a permanent resident by virtue of being their child.
So you stayed there and your parents went back.
Yeah, my parents
went back.
So
where were you living at the time?
In Auckland. So I actually went to uni. I was 16.
Yep.
And I started at Auckland Uni and I lived in the dorms in O'Rourke in Auckland.
How was that immersion experience for you? Did you find it easy to make local friends and sort of immerse yourself in the Kiwi culture, or what were the experiences?
You know, it's really interesting because one would think I was a person of Indian ethnicity growing up in Oman, moved to New Zealand for the first time when I was 16. I loved it. I think, you know, it's something I feel even today when I go back to New Zealand. I think you just kind of are like hit with the warmth of people. I think it's very understated. It's not sort of over the top, but I think it's like a very welcoming environment, at least Auckland, which is where I've spent a majority of my time. Mm. And O'Rourke was actually fantastic. I think Auckland Uni is such a little toss salad, melting pot, whatever you want to call it. There's so many different people of different ethnicities who kind of come together. And I think that was pretty formative for me.
Well, let's talk about the formative piece. I love to ask people about the inflection points and their early journeys. When did you realize that you didn't have to follow a conventional path? You've opted to take on the responsibility with Spark, the now Velocity, the Auckland University Business Competition and Community. Perhaps that's one, or even earlier than that. What sort of drove you to these paths you've taken?
It's a great question. I think what I find interesting is in hindsight, a lot of things make sense. And at the time, you're just sort of compounding the wisdom of others. I think we're always standing on the shoulders of giants, not just metaphorically, but also literally. So I think for me, velocity came at a time when I was doing my PhD in neuroscience at the Liggins Institute. Professor Peter Gluckman was my supervisor. Incredible, incredible human. And I think there was this one aspect in working with him. I think he was always a huge proponent of lateral thinking as opposed to reductionist science, which I think clearly kind of transcends.
Define those for us.
So I think reductionism would be sort of like you're kind of drilling down inwards versus lateral is like you're able to sort of see things at a higher level and looking for patterns and themes and like ways to converge different ideas across different disciplines. And I think, again, that's a longer conversation, which is interesting in its own right. But I think Peter just had like a very large vision for how science could help the world. And I think that was sort of the basis I was operating from. And for me, the inflection point was a pizza party in the Quad at Auckland Uni, as a lot of things go right. I'd heard about sort of this get together that PGSA, which is the Postgraduate Student Association of Auckland Uni, I think they were having a sit down with Jeff Witcher, who's since become a mentor, one of my closest friends and just incredible advisor. But I think it was around a couple of years after the knowledge wave. So it's January 2023. You know, there was sort of this rallying cry at the time about how you could make New Zealand more entrepreneurial. And I think we had these incredible, like the words that were being spoken. It's like, how do you turn academic ivory towers into revving engines of economic growth? It was fantastic. Mm. I was 21. I liked the pizza. And yeah, one thing led to another. And I, you know, was the founding CEO of Spark and then Velocity. And that was almost 20 years ago.
Yes, you said 2020. I think that was 2003.
2003.
And it was a long way from neuroscience. You were pursuing the neuroscience PhD. Because I want to double click on that one as well. What drove you to neuroscience?
I think it was actually the research that was happening in the lab. I think it was affiliated with Neuren Pharmaceuticals. My co-supervisor had done some incredible work in the discovery of a novel neuroregenerative protein. And I think it just like was just incredible to be a part of the work that he was doing. And it felt like, you know, just having the opportunity to push the conversation forward in kind of cutting edge work was really exciting.
Mm. I mean, a university entrepreneurship competition, sort of the default assumptions you might make would be, you know, young people building digital startups. Maybe it's in 2003, maybe it's a, you know, web page generator, maybe it's a pre-social networking. Where was the energy coming from within the university to sort of draw into this entrepreneurship cohort? Do you recall any of the other students that were pitching businesses? Do you recall any of the excitement that came through it at the time?
Actually, I think what was interesting at the time was, you know, one of the themes that we felt strongly about was there was a lot of academic research that we were worried was just sort of sitting on shelves. And actually, one of the first companies that came out of Spark, which has been obviously a massive success now in New Zealand, is powered by proxy, which Fadi Mashriki, who was one of the early team members in the first year of Velocity. He was there, and that was obviously like a deep tech hardware company. So it was instead of web tech, right? And so I think there was this desire to lean into hard technologies, which I think is where the university and its research divisions can shine. I remember Dr. Simon Malpass had a technology in the health tech med devices area. So I think, you know, it was actually very sort of core tech. And I think one of the things that's been really cool over the years, which, you know, I'm happy to go into later in the conversation too, but I believe there's like a company in the space tech.
Deno Astro's in Auckland.
Yes, exactly. That's been a company. And actually talking about, you know, obviously we wanted companies coming out of the Spark program to be successful. Mm. But our larger goal was to create a golden chain, as Jeff would put it, not a silver bullet. And I think the idea was this is going to take 20 years or more. And it's everyone who is influenced within that ecosystem is, you know, a part of what takes New Zealand forward. And I think that includes the companies that were started. But then also Alex Kendall behind Wave, he was actually not with Wave itself, but with, I believe, with an earlier company, one of the alumni of Velocity.
For the context, that was Alex was at Auckland University before going to Cambridge before starting Wave AI, which raised $1 billion last month. And
yes,
is certainly charging forward at a rate of knots. So Fadi was one and Zeno might have been another. Were there any sort of commonalities that you might have seen in those founders, like anything that made Fadi, you know, stand out back in those days? Or was it really...
I mean, forces of nature. I feel like people who drive change in the world are the people who are crazy enough to think that they can do so. I believe there's Steve Jobs said that, I think. Mm. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Coming around full circle. But, you know, again, I've known Fadi for a long time. And especially like we worked closely in the Velocity days. But yeah, he was a force of nature then. And I think he's a force of nature now.
Awesome. You, through a couple of sort of steps, found yourself in the US. You were the first commercial hire for LanzaTech over here, driving a lot of the international growth and commercialization. LanzaTech has the rightful place in New Zealand's sort of tech narrative history. It's been a success by many counts and lots of lessons and experience along the way. What would you share about like your landing with Lanza Tech and the journey that you went on over here?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have spent time there. I actually joined them right out of business school. And it was very interesting to sort of get that front row seat working with Sean Simpson and Vinod Khosla, who is one of the major investors in Lanza Tech. What I will say is looking back, I was so green, right? It's like, again, looking today where I was then, I was bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, but honestly, very early to the commercialization journey. And I think the idea at the time, I started the company in August 2008. The idea was that, you know, we're going to build out a large commercialization team, you know, hire people in the US on the commercial side. And that was around the time the financial crash happened. Mm. And suddenly I was the only commercial person. And we had an operating team or an operations team in Denver, which was a bunch of people from New Zealand that had moved here.
So give us a quick download on what you had wanted to happen. You were working with foundries. Help us understand the Lanza Tech product. What was the proposition in the market at that point?
What Lanza Tech at the time was doing, and again, it's been a long time since, so this is more from my memory. At the time, the proposition was we helped take steel mill flue gases and converted them into high-value fuel and chemicals. And actually, I think one of the stellar things that Lanza Tech did, which is a testament to Sean, who I was very fortunate to spend time with, which by the way is a slight segue and I'll come back. I think like being around people who set a high bar and was just brilliant, I think is incredible career-wise. I think it taught me a lot about the type of person I wanted to be as a founder. And I think that's, I've been fortunate to see that across the board in different instances, from Peter to Jeff to Sean, and even Vinod. I think just like an investor who just keeps a very high bar for the types of founders that he works with. And so anyway, but coming back to that time, I think where Lanza Tech was stellar compared to a lot of the companies in the ecosystem and the climate tech ecosystem was that a lot of the companies at the time were very bloated. They'd raised a lot of money, but I think the way Sean had built Lanza Tech was lean, and it was really sort of focused on being ingenious in terms of like how it maximized what it did with the money that it had raised. That part actually allowed for Lanza Tech to thrive, where a lot of companies in that environment just completely kind of got decimated over the years.
I've heard that and seen that in, you know, firsthand across, you know, the New Zealand startup scene to this date, is that quite often due to the capital constraints in the very early days of starting, people have to be lean, they have to think about profitability, and that can be a constraint when they're not growing quite so quickly. That can also be a huge benefit when they do break out and they're up against larger, better funded, but often more bloated competitors. Then, as you say, so 2008 happened, which was the financial crisis, and perhaps Lanza Tech's competitors might have been in even more trouble than
Were. I think it meant that the commercial team grow out was probably going to take longer. Also, the US was at an interesting point in history then, which is not, I don't know how much of it is true today, but a lot of the conversations around renewable fuels in the US were focused on fuels that were made from biomass, which was specifically biological feedstock. And Lanza Tech's primary fuel at the time was steel mill flue gas. And so we spent a lot of time in the US in regulatory conversations around like, hey, we should qualify. We're actually as sustainable, if not more sustainable, than a lot of counterparts who actually need to rely on these very expensive feedstock streams, which need to be grown. And obviously, there's a number of lobbying interests involved. So it was fascinating to sort of see the impact of regulation. I think obviously Lanza Tech, and you know, this is now ancient history, but Lanza Tech obviously decided to move to China shortly thereafter. That's when I transitioned out. I was in the US and they really kind of pushed with steel mills and had a lot of success with steel mills in China. But that was around the time that I, you know, shortly after started Blue Oak.
Brilliant. Well, we will shift there, but it is just a fascinating observation in the sense of the feedstock at Lanza Tech was the waste product of another output. Let's talk about Blue Oak. Now, you mentioned it was a little way after Lanza Tech. It might have been across some time at Singularity University. Tell us about that quickly. And you were involved in some of the energy initiatives, spanning a few of your, you know, academic and professional experiences at that point. And what was Blue Oak?
Yeah, again, it feels like a long time ago now, but I was invited to be on the faculty advisory group at Singularity University. We were sort of really trying to create an environment. This was based out of Mountain View in NASA, but really sort of helping curious, innovatively minded people push the frontiers on where cutting edge technologies were, especially in sort of hard tech areas. And so around that time, met someone who became my co-founder, Bryce Goodman, incredible human. And really the idea at the time for Blue Oak started with a sense of like, we generate massive amounts of electronic waste streams. Moore's law dictates that that's going to become more and more prevalent. These are highly concentrated waste streams in terms of the value that they hold with precious metals, rare earth elements, et cetera. And we got our first funding funding from Kleiner. We were fortunate to actually work with phenomenal investors at the time. And
give us a timestamp on this. We're talking 2011-12?
Yeah. So 2011 was when we closed our funding round. And yeah.
I mean, Kleiner were famous for being one of the most bullish on the clean tech wave, which was a little bit before that, but they're obviously still in and still investing. And this was not just clean tech promise, but it was clean tech reality and a real, you know, problem, extracting the valuable minerals, gold, silver, copper from e-waste. What was the e-waste? Was it laptops?
You know, when I talk about starting a company, one of this will tie to your question in terms of what the e-waste was. You know, it's like when you first have an idea, you know, there's the idea of the idea that you're working on and there's the reality of the idea that you're working on. You know, for us, I think the purpose behind what we were doing was because we felt from everything we'd seen, large waste streams, massively polluting in underdeveloped parts of the world, right. It felt like this massive problem that should be solved. And I still believe it should be solved today. I think it's a huge problem. It's continuing to grow and it requires a solution. In terms of the type of e-waste, I think, you know, when you dive deeper and deeper into a market and you peel the layers of the onion, what you realize is the problem you think you're solving and the problem you're actually solving start looking very different. And so a specific example of that was that a lot of the e-waste that was the consumer e-waste, actually, at least at the time, was extremely fragmented. Like there weren't the right incentives to recycle that. So actually, that was a collection issue first and then a separation issue.
Right, so it's all ending up in the dump at the moment and just diverting it from the dump to somewhere that you can feasibly economically collect
extract
in the first
value
place.
Exactly. Right. So because our proposition was that we were focused on the extraction of value side, we realized that there's this whole massive gap on the collection side around consumer e-waste and also separating it, because a lot of recycling is most efficient when you have really good separation by type. Where that led us to is actually enterprise scale e-waste. So like companies and the e-waste that they generate, there were actually very good, I would say reasonable collection mechanisms in place for that. And you know, what you then do is you take a lot of these high value electronic waste streams, laptops, servers, chips, etc. You separate those out and you actually basically, for the extraction portion, you're really interested in the inside. So the chips or the circuit boards, not the devices. And what you then realize is, you know, where a lot of people even today think that there's these large volumes of e-waste which have value and you can get them for free. No, these are actually commodity streams. At the point at which you've separated out the scrap from the waste, which is the only thing that you can take through a facility, that's already a commodity. So it's not like you actually have to pay people to get that. And really the business that you're in is tolling, right? So you can actually charge a fee to the person. So if you get a pallet of scrap, of circuit boards for me, which is, you know, at the time it was worth around $7 a pound of scrap, I could charge you, again, you know, round numbers, $1 to help process it. And there are already existing smelters around the world that process that stuff. So that's sort of part two of kind of this epiphany around, like, you know, what's the business you're actually in? The smelters, you do, they actually extract about 98 to 99% of the value already.
Yeah.
So it's not like the stuff's going to waste. It's not. The value that you're really adding is domestically, you're able to pay people faster because by the time they ship it overseas and they extract value, it will take time. And in order to pay people faster, you actually have to be very good at assessing what the value in it is, because if you don't have a good sense of how much value there is in the scrap, you could overpay people. And so it was a valuing, sort of sampling and valuing business, and it was a financing business. And then you're talking about having a hedging department. You're talking about having like a finance. I mean, it was a very different.
It's fascinating to peel back the, as you say, the layers of the onion of a business like this. One of my first observations is that actually Blue Oak and LanzaTech were similar in a sense of they both took a waste output from another industry or another, you know, production process. And you then have to think in terms of systems at stages of the waste output. You know, maybe you're taking it directly from the factory or maybe taking it directly from the large enterprise. But there's a sorting question, like, do we take all of the gases or do we take all of the electro output? You know, or do you just get the circuit boards? Or do you just get the refined metals that have come from the circuit boards? And in each step of those, you're sort of building a process. And as you say, you're, what was the word, charging a toll along the way.
Yeah, it's a tolling business model. And what I would sort of further add to that is I think in any business, there's the business you think you're getting into and there's the business you're getting into, right? And I think like the shorter the distance between the first and the second, I actually think we did a pretty good job in figuring that out fairly quickly. But it's definitely a learning especially in hard tech, right? Because these are sort of complex ecosystems with existing players. You know, another thing that we couldn't have predicted in that journey is that because there were large smelters who have large capacities, even if we were more competitive in various ways to access the scrap, they could actually pay people, let's say a pound of scrap is $7, they could pay people $8 or $9, which basically like they're taking a loss just to keep their supply.
Right, because they've got the fixed cost of the smelter. Now, you had your own refinery at one point as well. You're out in Arkansas?
Yes.
That must have meant assuming your own fixed costs and overhead, and obviously you'd raise a lot of money. I'm very curious because I bet there are very few Kiwis, you know, members of the expat community who've gone the extent of building a refinery in Arkansas or anything close to that. If you could talk to your 2011 self, what would you tell them?
I think of that often. And I'll give you a little anecdote, and this probably dates me because around 2006, 2008, when I was in business school, but I was sort of exposed to startups. And even when I was raising money for my company, I think there was this idea amongst VCs of like what your five-year exit plan was going to look like. You actually had a slide on a five-year exit plan. And I think particularly in my first company, I think you have this idea that, you know, it's reasonable to expect exits in 5 years. And I think the thing I would probably go back and tell myself is anything you do, anything that you build value in is going to take at least 10 to 20 years. And I think just understanding that, you know, because when you think those time horizons are shorter, because that's what the prevalent wisdom is, like you're always like, well, it should be, you know, why is this not there sooner? And particularly in deep tech, which are often not platform-based, which has all of the elements where software is successful, it's cheap, it's, you know, you can rely on sort of word of mouth, there's sort of virality, all of that. A lot of deep tech is project-based. So there's a certain amount of linearity. You've got to get one facility to work really well before you can build a second facility. And the types of partners you need along the way, everyone around the table really needs to understand that, you know, the first time you're doing something, it's likely going to take 20 years. So who are the types of investors who are buying into that?
Yes, certainly coming in with eyes open as to the timeline, the work involved. I'm curious, how did the story end with Blue Rock? I mean, Blue Rock's not active today, raised money and ultimately built something really valuable at the point in time. What was the journey onwards for you?
Yeah, so I actually transitioned out of the company late 2017, early 2018. And essentially, like the company got into a dispute with one of its vendors. And that's probably another learning. When things get legal, everything kind of comes to a standstill. But the facility itself got acquired by Glencore, which is one of the largest mining companies in the world. And from what I read recently, their goal is to make that one of the largest processing or pre-processing facilities in North America or in the continent. So I think there's a lot of, you know, points along the journey, which you look back and we're like, you know, would things have been different at any one of those points? And one that comes to mind, and I think it was hard for everyone involved in the company, was the founding executive chairman. He'd come on a couple of years after we'd started the company, but was, you know, he's one of the reasons why we moved to Arkansas. This was the former CEO of Nucor, which is one of those classic stories of disruption that Clay Christensen writes about in The Innovator's Dilemma. But John Corenti was a behemoth. I mean, he was, again, one of those incredible people who I was very fortunate to have spent time with. And he actually helped get a large number of our investors beyond our early investors. You know, we were about to go into a supplier meeting with a vendor. And we find out, you know, like we're all sort of around the table saying, hey, why is John not here? And it turns out he passed away.
Oh, gosh.
And it's like, you know, so that's another one of those things I'd probably tell my 2011 self. It's like tail risks are real.
Yes.
Like you might choose not to act on it, but you need to understand them.
Yes.
And so, yeah.
Tail risks like those are very hard to prepare for. But the point is, you know, understand that it's going to be an incredibly volatile journey and build the resiliency into yourself and your advisory board and your executive team.
Or like, how do you make sure that the business isn't at any point very dependent on any one person,
yeah,
right?
Key man risk. Right,
yeah, totally. Key man risk, exactly, which we've taken into account in our current business.
Absolutely. We should transition to talk about that. So today, you're a busy woman. You've got a lot of stuff on your plate. Plank seems like the core focus, and I'm really excited to talk about what the future holds around AI-enabled engineering teams. You're also involved in the World Economic Forum. You've been getting back involved in University of Auckland. The bigger question is, how do you think about allocating your time today? What excites you the most? What's drawing you in?
Love that question. So actually, like, you know, as a part of sort of thinking about who I am and who I am today, I think the thing that I am incredibly excited about is sort of the point in history where we are, speed at which innovation is happening across AI, across med tech, you know, biotech, climate tech. So it feels exhilarating to be alive at this point in history. And I know it's a very challenging time around the world in so many ways. And it's depressing. And a lot of conversations with friends around, like, you know, how dystopian it feels often. But I think the thing I remind myself, and I think this ties to like what keeps me excited, is I think what we as humans, a deeply flawed and imperfect species, have proven time and time again, is that we somehow managed to build a world that is on average better for humans than 500 years ago. And so to feel like that, you know, has held true always, and we also are at an innovation inflection point more so than ever before, feels incredibly exciting. It also is something that I, you know, if you ask me what's the thing that keeps me up at night, is finding the strength to focus, because there's so many opportunities, even in what we're building, right? Like, so as I said before, we at Planck help businesses build remote engineering teams that are AI enabled. As I mentioned, we started before COVID at a time where people were sort of very dubious about remote. And now, you know, then suddenly people got very excited about remote. I think we've been very tempered. We're very opinionated about remote. And I'll say a small thing there, that I think people confuse remote in terms of, there's actually two axes to remote. Like, are you in a particular city? Do you have a hub and spoke model, or are you completely distributed? Right. That's one axis. And the other one is, are you in office? Are you hybrid? Or are you completely work from home? And those can be independent. And so what we always believed in is that, you know, at a certain stage in the company, you could have a hub and spoke model. So like functional teams that are elsewhere, but still co-located. So we're very opinionated about the co-located piece. I say that as a plug because I feel like, you know, people kind of get, they're all over about remote. And so when we were excited about remote, I think everyone was like, oh, this is ridiculous. And then people were like hyped up about remote. We were like, no, that's actually ridiculous.
Yeah. You've been the steady influence through the middle. Yeah.
Well, it's sort of like, you know, if you're working in a field, you kind of get to look past the Gartner hype cycle.
I used to have a framework, which was that in person was for innovation and distributed is for iteration. Mm-hmm. Like in order to be a distributed company, whichever the axis you're across, and I like your framework there. It's sort of, you can be hybrid, you can be totally distributed, but you have to really overinvest in the legibility of your plans and the communication of those plans and have everybody on the same page of what we're building. And when, if you are going to be a very small startup who is still innovating, who's still pre-product market fit, then the value gained from being in person is undeniable. You've sort of spoken around this in a couple of ways, so I want to put the question to you direct. Planck serves clients in X way. So I am a client. I would come in, engage you. You'll put together the engineering team for me. You'll help me optimize the way I work with that engineering team, both in person and remotely.
Mm-hmm. And then I think a part of that, which then, you know, I want to segue into your earlier question around how I think about my time today. But what we also sort of realized very quickly is that when it comes to qualified, high quality talent, there's actually a supply constraint, not a demand constraint. Like, everyone wants great engineers. Everyone wants to accelerate engineering velocity. Engineers are a means to an end. And a part of accelerating engineering velocity is having a high functioning team that's ready to go on day one, is flexible, and can work with you in the long term if you're interested. And I think those were the aspects that we were excited to solve. And I think a part that sort of like come into it is the AI piece, which I think, you know, obviously changes the nature of software over time. So I think in terms of what's sort of top of mind for me is, one, what AI means for the world generally. I think it's an area I'm personally very interested in. I've been building products sort of for fun in this for a long time. My most recent one was actually a take on The Onion. It was called Garlic GPT.
Okay.
And it was just basically like AI-generated humor.
Can I find Garlic GPT on the internet?
We're actually like revamping it, but it was on the front page of Hacker News for a while.
I'm going to go track that one down for one.
And I'll let you know when it's up and run again. But the thing where it ties to what we're doing is software engineering. The nature of that's changing. I think we're all sort of thinking about timelines. And we constantly remind ourselves that there's a gap between what technology can enable is possible and when it's adopted. You know, we still talk to larger companies who are thinking about whether they want to be on-prem or cloud. There's companies who have like large legacy systems and, you know, they would like to kind of convert into more modern systems. So I think for us, the opportunity of being a tech-enabled services company, we see that as massive. But even within that, there are so many different things that we could be building that focus, especially because we have the benefit of choice.
One observation that I think is aligned with yours just now is that sometimes in Silicon Valley, in tech bubbles, it's very easy to get caught up in the assumption that AI is about to change everything and it's going to happen all at once. Actually, when you step out of that and you go back to mainstream New Zealand or basically anywhere else in the world, most companies are still debating the same questions that they've been debating for the last 10 years. And I do, you know, wonder what pace is this really going to roll out? At what pace is the impact going to be felt? I think that the leading edge is accelerating away faster and faster, but the mainstream isn't necessarily keeping up. So
you'll
be in that spot in the middle trying to recruit top engineers, trying to build teams and manage.
And actually trying to train people. So I think one of the programs that we have, you know, we've kind of implemented and we're excited to grow is actually fellowships. So one of the things that we do is we work with universities in small towns.
Okay.
We're located around there and we actually help some of the smartest kids from those universities access a paid fellowship just to kind of like kickstart their career. And that's been something that's been very gratifying to see. And I think, again, tying back full circle to your question around like time, for me, obviously, this is primary, but I think the two areas that I continue to kind of keep alive and spend time on outside of core work is just sort of where AI is headed and the opportunities that I think it unfolds beyond sort of what we're currently working on. And then also New Zealand and what the next 20 years of the innovation ecosystem look like. I think that's just very close to my heart.
Well, let's double click on that because this idea of the fellowship and finding students from universities around the world and helping them get access to this work experience that's getting paid, that's something I'd love to see more of back home as well. And you've recently been back involved in Auckland University in a little way. I'm curious if you've been tracking Velocity, tracking any of the local entrepreneurship programs, tracking any of the activities, and perhaps from your perspective of the past 20 years, what could we be doing better?
So actually, I'll do a little plug for what Velocity, which is actually since then, like, you know, so I started Velocity in Kaiasman. I think that ecosystem has grown in much larger into this.
And just to check them, so Velocity is now the successor to Spark. Spark was the original entrepreneurship competition community that you and Fadi and others were involved in, and Kaiasman was a version of that, but for biotechnology. Is that correct?
So it was, Kaiasman was focused on, I co-founded that a year after Velocity, and that was focused on helping students and members of the biotech community at the university connect with the enterprise sector and government. And so that's continuing to grow as well. And then I think that there's a larger ecosystem around, which I believe is called the Center of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Auckland Uni.
Yep.
You know, I believe they've been doing incredibly well, but I believe that Velocity and CIE, the alumni, which we think of as people who've started companies or have been involved with either of those initiatives in some way, they've gone on to start, I believe, over 270 companies.
Wow.
Raised $3.1 billion.
Yep.
And have hired over 3,000 people in 184 countries. And I think if we sort of rewind the clock back to 20 years, that would have exceeded our wildest imaginations in terms of the scope of impact. You know, at any point, can we have more? Yes. You know, it reminds me of the Peter Thiel quote, which is, or some version of it, I'm sure I'm paraphrasing, but what is it that you want to do in 10 years and what's stopping you from doing it in 6 months?
Mm.
And so there's always more you can do.
I love it.
But I think that, you know, the ecosystem building takes decades. And what someone reminded me on a recent trip to New Zealand, I think it was Jeff actually, who said that, you know, we're actually pretty early, right? Like we're still early in our ecosystem development. So one of the things that I think that we could do in New Zealand is really sort of focus on force of nature people and talent ecosystems. And the example kind of, you know, going back in conversation is LanzaTech. So if you think of, you know, a number of like awesome companies that I believe have started in New Zealand were actually people who worked at LanzaTech at some point in time. And that's just one example, right? And, you know, in the Valley, it's very common to think of the PayPal mafia or the Stripe mafia. I mean, that's sort of a well understood and followed phenomenon. And I think it'd be really interesting to see how these pockets of forces of nature people, be it Velocity, CIE, LanzaTech, other awesome companies, like, are we really investing in those people?
I like this, forces of nature. I'm going to acronym it to FONS straight away. And we need to both inspire and develop more FONS and support them, identify them when they do. And you can almost say that a program like Velocity, like its, you know, peers at other universities, they should be designed to help people who feel passionate and driven about something, anything, opt in and build a community of their peers, those who also have ambition. I think the Paul Graham quote that I've always loved, which was, yeah, ambitious people are rare, but they're evenly distributed.
Yes.
And if they are left languishing in, you know, on their own, often the ambition can taper off. You have a mean reversion back into society. In fact, one of the highest leverage things you can do is to pluck them out of where they might be and put them together, which is one of the things that makes San Francisco so impactful because it does sort of self-select for global ambition to really flow in.
And I mean, if I can double click on what you just said, one of the things that happens in these businesses that, you know, eventually become super successful is they've been really good at recruiting those people and bringing them together. And so they've kind of had that shared energy that they carry forward.
Right.
I actually think that leads me to one of the second things that I think it's important for us to be aware of in New Zealand, which is that I think, you know, we always talk about being ambitious. I think that's incredibly important. I think two subparts to that, valuations aren't value creation. I think there are a lot of metrics that drive value creation. Valuations can often be a vanity metric. And so I think being enamored by that can often be distracting. That's one. But the second one, which I think is more important even, is really sort of encouraging people who've been first-time founders and want to be second-time founders. Like, I think we always talk about celebrating failure. I actually have a personally nuanced take on that, which is, you know, there's the failure for risk-taking, there's failure of competence. And when you're a founder, I'm sure there's some combination of mistakes you're making, but a lot of it is risk-taking, right? So for the type of person who's failed at being a founder the first time, or their first company hasn't succeeded, but they've found it in themselves to actually go out and do it again, I think we kind of need to nurture.
Yeah, celebrate that.
Celebrate that Absolutely. Aspect and also support and encourage that.
Yep. To me, it feels like what in Silicon Valley, for example, might be a very common path to start a company, doesn't work out, start another company. Let's say 50 to 75% of people do that. In New Zealand, I think that it's tranched into three. One would be people who start a company, it's successful, they make enough money that they check out rich. And there's been a few examples of that. Build a house, buy a batch, buy a boat. I think the three Bs were the classic, the boat, the batch, and BMW. The other is people who start a company, it doesn't work out, and they're just spent, like burnt out, because it is hard to start a company, period. And also, if you're doing it from New Zealand and you spent the last 5 or 10 years flying around the world, dealing with suboptimal capital structures.
Sorry, just on that, being super afraid of failing, because that's reputational. It's not seen as a, like over here, people will say like, you know, I failed like 4 times before building my first successful company, right? I think that's a conversation that needs to be encouraged. Again, you know, being an entrepreneur is not for everybody. And I think people should understand that it's a really hard journey.
Yep.
But if it's one that you're willing to keep taking and keep getting better each time, you're hopefully going to do it better the second time around than you are the first.
And of course, we're here talking about over there, but while sitting in the US, what's your take on ambitious people leaving the country to go and pursue the dream, to surround themselves with ambitious people? For example, in San Francisco, I personally am one to push people to lean into the opportunity, perhaps go home once they're ready. What's the conversation you'd have with an 18-year-old who's looking ahead to their career today?
I think what I'd say is be authentic with yourself. Like, I think you live one life and, you know, build the thing that you want to build if no one was watching. And so I think as long as like leaving and being around extremely ambitious people in the Valley or like being a part of a certain ecosystem is authentically exciting to you, do that, because that'll come around full circle and you'll have enjoyed that. And if you reach a point where you want to kind of go back to New Zealand, that'll happen. Or if you're in a position, which I find myself in, is I want to be a part of that ecosystem. I believe I could still do that from here.
Yeah.
You could do that. And then there might be someone who's like, hey, there's a number of reasons I actually feel very committed to building here. The types of things I want to build are in New Zealand.
Yep.
And I would say for that person, like, do what is authentically you.
Which is the perfect setup for my final question, which is you are here, you know, because this is where you want to be. We want to make sure that you can be a part of this network, that also this network can help you. So my final part is, how can we help you? How can we bend the diaspora to your benefit? Like, are there any dream partners, customers you'd like to work with? Are there any people you'd like to hire? How can we help?
I feel like I'm the result today of the compounding benefit of doubt a lot of people gave me over the years. And so in terms of the types of people within the diaspora that I would like to connect with, I think there's actually a number. I think there's, you know, companies who might be curious about how to build remote engineering teams, how to think about building an engineering workforce in an AI-enabled universe. And, you know, again, just conversationally happy to share what we've learned. We've had such a large set of customers come to us through referrals that, you know, honestly, like just being able to pay it forward in some way, I think has been hugely beneficial for us. So happy to have that conversation. And I would say beyond that, for me, forces of nature who are helping drive New Zealand's innovation ecosystem forward over the next 20 years, because I think that's sort of a personal passion for me.
Awesome. Where can we find you, follow you online?
Twitter, LinkedIn, the usual, email.
Great.
Yeah.
Happy to do that. Thank you so much. It's been fun. Really enjoyed the conversation and looking forward to following along on your journey as it goes.
Thanks, David. One of these days I want to do this sitting on the other side with you.
That'll be fun.
Awesome.
We'll get there. Thank you so much. Cheers.